along the old Cumberland Trail that stretched from Louisville to Nashville. Caravans of pioneers passed by each day, heading toward the northwest. Farmers, peddlers, preachers, each with a tale to tell. Night after night, Thomas Lincoln would swap tales with visitors and neighbors, while his young son sat transfixed in the corner. In these sociable settings, Thomas was in his element. A born storyteller, he possessed a quick wit, a talent for mimicry, and an uncanny memory for exceptional stories. These qualities would prove his greatest bequest to his son. Young Abe listened so intently to these stories, crafted from experiences of everyday life, that the words became embedded in his memory. Nothing was more upsetting to him, he recalled decades later, nothing made him angrier than his inability to comprehend everything that was told. After listening to adults chatter through the evening, he would spend, he said, no small part of the night walking up and down and trying to make out what was the exact meaning of some of their, to me, dark sayings. Unable to sleep, he would reformulate the conversations until, as he recalled, I had put it in language plain enough, as I thought, for any boy I knew to comprehend. The following day, having translated the stories into words and ideas that his friends could grasp, he would climb onto the tree stump or log that served as an impromptu stage and mesmerize his own circle of young listeners. He had discovered the pride and pleasure an attentive audience could bestow. This great storytelling talent and oratorical skill would eventually constitute his stock in trade throughout both his legal and political careers. The passion for rendering experience into powerful language remained with Lincoln throughout his life. The only schools in rural Kentucky and Indiana were subscription schools, requiring families to pay a tuition. Even when frontier families could afford the expense, their children did not always receive much education. No qualification was ever required of a teacher, Lincoln recalled, beyond readin', writin', and cipherin', to the rule of three. If a straggler, supposed to understand Latin, happened to sojourn in the neighborhood, he was looked upon as a wizard. Allowed to attend school only by littles, between stints of farm work, the aggregate of all his schooling, Lincoln admitted years later, did not amount to 1 year. He had never even set foot inside of a college or academy building until he acquired his license to practice law. What he had in the way of education, he lamented, he had to pick up on his own. Books became his academy, his college. The printed word united his mind with the great minds of generations past. Relatives and neighbors recalled that he scoured the countryside for books and read every volume he could lay his hands on. At a time when ownership of books remained a luxury for those Americans living outside the purview of the middle class, gaining access to reading material proved difficult. When Lincoln obtained copies of the King James Bible, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Aesop's Fables, and William Scott's Lessons in Elocution, he could not contain his excitement. Holding Pilgrim's Progress in his hands, his eyes sparkled, and that day he could not eat, and that night he could not sleep. When printing was first invented, Lincoln would later write, the great mass of men were utterly unconscious that their conditions or their minds were capable of improvement. To liberate the mind from this false and underestimate of itself is the great task which printing came into the world to perform. He was, of course, also speaking of himself, of the transforming liberation of a young boy unlocking the miraculous mysteries of language, discovering a world of possibilities in the small log cabin on the frontier he later called as unpoetical as any spot of the earth. "There is no frigate like a book," wrote Emily Dickinson, "to take us lands away." Though the young Lincoln never left the frontier, would never leave America, he traveled with Byron's Childe Harold to Spain and Portugal, the Middle East and Italy, accompanied Robert Burns to Edinburgh, and followed the English kings into battle with Shakespeare. As he explored the wonders of literature and the history of the country, the young Lincoln, already conscious of his own power, developed ambitions far beyond the expectations of his family and neighbors. It was through literature that he was able to transcend his surroundings. He read and reread the Bible and Aesop's fables so many times that years later he could recite whole passages and entire stories from memory. Through Scott's Lessons in Elocution, he first encountered selections from Shakespeare's plays, inspiring a love for the great dramatist's writings long before he ever saw a play. He borrowed a volume of the Revised Statutes of Indiana from the local constable, a work that contained the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, documents that would become foundation stones of his philosophical and political thought. Everywhere he went, Lincoln carried a book with him. He thumbed through page after page while his horse rested at the end of a long row of planting. Whenever he could escape work, he would lie with his head against a tree and read. Though he acquired only a handful of volumes, they were seminal works of the English language. Reading the Bible and Shakespeare over and over implanted rhythms and poetry that would come to fruition in those works of his maturity which made Abraham Lincoln our only poet president. With remarkable energy and tenacity, he quarried the thoughts and ideas that he wanted to remember. When he came across a passage that struck him, his stepmother recalled, he would write it down on boards if he had no paper, and when the board would get too black, he would shave it off with a drawing knife and go on again. Then, once he obtained paper, he would rewrite it and keep it in a scrapbook so that it could be memorized. Words thus became precious to him, never, as with Seward, to be lightly or indiscriminately used. The volumes to feed Lincoln's intellectual hunger did not come cheaply. The story is often recounted of the time he borrowed Parson Weems's Life of George Washington from Josiah Crawford, a well-to-do farmer who lived 16 miles away. Thrilled by this celebrated account of the first president's life, he took the book to his loft at night, where, by the light of a tallow candle, or, if tallow was scarce, by a grease lamp made from hickory bark gathered in the woods, he read as long as he could stay awake, placing the book on a makeshift shelf between the cabin logs so he could retrieve it at daybreak. During a severe rainstorm one night, the book was badly soiled and the covers warped. Lincoln went to Crawford's house, explained what had happened, and offered to work off the value of the book. Crawford calculated the value of 2 full days' work pulling corn, which Lincoln considered an unfair reimbursement. Nevertheless, he straightway set to work and kept on until there was not a corn blade left on a stalk. Then, having paid his debt, Lincoln wrote poems and songs lampooning Josiah blowing his bugle, Crawford's large nose. Thus, Crawford, in return for loaning Lincoln a book and then exorbitantly penalizing him, won a permanent, if unflattering, place in American history. A lucid, inquisitive, and extraordinarily dogged mind was Lincoln's native endowment. Already he possessed a vivid sensibility for the beauty of the English language. Often reading aloud, he was attracted to the sound of language along with its meaning, its music and rhythms. He found this in poetry, and to the end of his life would recite poems, often lengthy passages, from memory. He seemed especially drawn to poetry that spoke of our doomed mortality and the transience of earthly achievements. For clearly, Lincoln, this acolyte of pure reason and remorseless logic, was also a romantic. All three of Lincoln's rivals shared his early love of books, but none had as difficult a task securing them or finding the leisure to read. In the household of his classically educated father, Seward had only to pick a book from well-stocked shelves, while both local academies he attended and Union College maintained substantial collections of books on history, logic, rhetoric, philosophy, chemistry, grammar, and geography. Chase likewise had access to libraries at his uncle's boys' school in Worthington and at Dartmouth College. And while books weren't plentiful where Bates grew up, he had the luxury of his scholarly relative's home, where he could peruse at will an extensive collection. The distance between the educational advantages Lincoln's rivals enjoyed and the hardships he endured was rendered even greater by the cultural resistance Lincoln faced once his penchant for reading became known. In the pioneer world of rural Kentucky and Indiana, where physical labor was essential for survival, and mental exertion was rarely considered a legitimate form of work, Lincoln's book hunger was regarded as odd and indolent. Nor would his community understand the thoughts and emotions stirred by his reading. There were few to talk to about the most important and deeply experienced activities of his mind. While Lincoln's stepmother took particular care not to disturb him, would let him read on and on till he quit of his own accord, his father needed help with the tiresome chores of felling trees, digging up stumps, splitting rails, plowing, weeding, and planting. When he found his son in the field reading a book, or worse still, distracting fellow workers with tales or passages from one of his books, he would angrily halt the activity so work could continue. The boy's endeavors to better himself often incurred the resentment of his father, who occasionally destroyed his books and may have physically abused him. Lincoln's relationship with his father grew strained, particularly when his last chance for schooling was foreclosed by his father's decision to hire him out. He labored for various neighbors, butchering hogs, digging wells, and clearing land, in order to satisfy a debt the family had incurred. Such conflict between father and son was played out in thousands of homes, as the self-made men in Lincoln's generation sought to pursue ambitions beyond the cramped lives of their fathers. The same longing to rise that carried Seward away from the Hudson Valley brought Chase to the infant state of Ohio and Bates to the Missouri Territory, propelled Lincoln from Indiana to New Salem, Illinois. At 22, he departed his family home with all his meager possessions bundled on his shoulder. New Salem was a budding town with 25 families, 3 general stores, a tavern, a blacksmith shop, a cooper shop, and a tannery. Working simply to keep body and soul together as a flatboatman, clerk, merchant, postmaster, and surveyor, he engaged in a systematic regimen of self-improvement. He mastered the principles of English grammar at night when the store was closed. He carried Shakespeare's plays and books of poetry when he walked along the streets. Seated in the local post office, he devoured newspapers. He studied geometry and trigonometry while learning the art of surveying. And then, at the age of 25, he decided to study law. In a time when young men were apprenticed to practicing lawyers while they read the law, Lincoln, by his own account, studied with nobody. Borrowing law books from a friend, he set about on his own to gain the requisite knowledge and skills. He buried himself in the dog-eared pages of Blackstone's Commentaries. He unearthed the thoughts in Chitty's Pleadings. He analyzed precepts in Greenleaf's Evidence and Story's Equity Jurisprudence. After a long day at one of his various jobs, he would read far into the night. A steadfast purpose sustained him. Few of his colleagues experienced so solitary or steep a climb to professional proficiency. The years Seward and Chase spent in college eased the transition into legal study by exposing them to history, classical languages, and scientific reasoning. What is more, Lincoln had no outlet for discourse, no mentor such as Seward found in the distinguished author of The Practice. Nor did Lincoln have the social advantages Chase enjoyed by reading law with the celebrated William Wirt, or the connections Bates derived from Rufus Easton. What Lincoln lacked in preparation and guidance, he made up for with his daunting concentration, phenomenal memory, acute reasoning faculties, and interpretive penetration. Though untutored in the sciences and the classics, he was able to read and reread his books until he understood them fully. "Get the books and read and study them," he told a law student seeking advice in 1855. "It did not matter," he continued, "whether the reading be done in a small town or a large city, by oneself or in the company of others. The books, and your capacity for understanding them, are just the same in all places. Always bear in mind that your own resolution to succeed is more important than any other one thing." The following poem is from Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters. I am Anne Rutledge, who sleep beneath these weeds, beloved in life of Abraham Lincoln, wedded to him, not through union, but through separation. Bloom forever, O Republic, from the dust of my bosom. At New Salem, Lincoln would take his law books into the woods and stretch out on a wooded knoll to read. On these forays he was likely accompanied by Anne Rutledge, whose father owned Rutledge's Tavern, where Lincoln boarded from time to time. Anne Rutledge was, to our knowledge, Lincoln's first and perhaps most passionate love. Years after her death, he reportedly divulged his feelings for her to an old friend, Isaac Cogdale. When Cogdale asked whether he had been in love, Lincoln replied, "It is true. True indeed. She was a handsome girl. Would have made a good, loving wife. I did honestly and truly love the girl, and think often, often of her now." Not a single piece of correspondence has been uncovered to document the particulars of their relationship. It must be pieced together from the recollections of neighbors and friends in the small, closely knit community of New Salem. Anne was a few years younger than Lincoln, had eyes blue, large, and expressive, auburn hair, and a beautiful face. She was beloved by everybody. Her intellect was said to be quick, sharp, deep, and philosophic, as well as brilliant. New Salem resident William Green believed she was a woman worthy of Lincoln's love. What began as a friendship between Anne and Abraham turned at some point into romance. They shared an understanding, according to friends, that they would marry after Anne completed her studies at the Female Academy at Jacksonville. Anne was only 22 in the summer of 1835. While New Salem sweltered through one of the hottest summers in the history of the state, a deadly fever, possibly typhoid, spread through the town. Anne, as well as several of Lincoln's friends, perished in the epidemic. After Anne's death, Abraham seemed indifferent to transpiring events, one neighbor recalled, had but little to say, but would take his gun and wander off in the woods by himself. Elizabeth Abel, a New Salem neighbor who had become a surrogate mother to Lincoln, claimed she had never seen a man mourn for a companion more than he did. His melancholy deepened on dark and gloomy days, for he could never be reconciled, he said, to have the snow, rains, and storms to beat on her grave. Acquaintances feared he had become temporarily deranged, and that unless he pulled himself together, reason would desert her throne. Lincoln himself admitted that he ran off the track a little after Anne's death. He had now lost the three women to whom he was closest, his mother, his sister, and Anne. Reflecting on a visit to his childhood home in Indiana some years later, he wrote a mournful poem. I hear the loved survivors tell how naught from death could save, till every sound appears a knell, and every spot a grave. He was not crazy, maintained Elizabeth Abel. He was simply very sad. Only people who are capable of loving strongly, Leo Tolstoy wrote, can also suffer great sorrow. But this same necessity of loving serves to counteract their grief and heal them. Had Lincoln, like Chase, lived in a large city when Anne died, he might have concealed his grief behind closed doors. In the small community of New Salem, there was no place to hide, except perhaps the woods toward which he gravitated. Moreover, as he brooded over Anne's death, he could find no consolation in the prospect of a reunion in the hereafter. When his New Salem friend and neighbor, Mrs. Samuel Hill, asked him whether he believed in a future realm, he answered no. I'm afraid there isn't, he replied sorrowfully. It isn't a pleasant thing to think that when we die, that is the last of us. Though later statements make reference to an omnipotent God or supreme power, there is no mention in any published document, the historian Robert Bruce observes, except in one ambiguous letter to his dying father, of any faith in life after death. To the end of his life, he was haunted by the finality of death and the evanescence of earthly accomplishments. Lincoln's inability to take refuge in the concept of a Christian heaven sets him apart from Chase and Bates. While Chase admitted that his heart was broken when he buried his second wife, Eliza Smith, he was convinced that all is not dark, the cloud is fringed with light. Unlike his first wife, Kitty, Eliza had died trusting in Jesus. He could therefore picture her in heaven, waiting for him to join her in eternal companionship. Sharing the faith that gave solace to Chase, Bates was certain when his 9-year-old daughter, Edwa, died, that she had been called by God to a higher world and to higher enjoyment. In the child's last hours, he related, she talked with calmness and apparently without alarm of her approaching death. She did not fear to die. Still, the only reason she gave for not wishing to die was that she would rather stay with her mother. Seward shared Lincoln's doubt that any posthumous reunion beckoned. When his wife and precious 21-year-old daughter Fanny died within 16 months of each other, he was devastated. I ought to be able to rejoice that Fanny was withdrawn from me to be reunited with her mother, the pure and blessed spirit that formed her own, he told a friend. But unfortunately, I am not spiritual enough to find support in these reflections. If Lincoln, like Seward, confronted the loss of loved ones without prospect of finding them in the afterlife to assuage the loss, one begins to comprehend the weight of his sorrow when Anne died. Nonetheless, he completed his study of law and received his law license and the offer to become a partner with John Stewart, the friend whose law books he had borrowed. In April 1837, 20 months after Ann Rutledge's death, Lincoln left New Salem for Springfield, Illinois, then a community of about 1,500 people. There he planned to embark upon what he termed his experiment in law. With no place to stay and no money to buy provisions, he wandered into the general store in the town square. He asked the young proprietor, Joshua Speed, how much it would cost to buy the furniture for a single bed, the mattress, blankets, sheets, coverlid, and pillows. Speed estimated the cost at $17, which Lincoln agreed was perhaps cheap enough, though he lacked the funds to cover that amount. He asked if Speed might advance him credit until Christmas time, when, if his venture with law worked out, he would pay in full. "If I fail in this," added Lincoln abjectly, "I do not know that I can ever pay you." Speed surveyed the tall, discomfited figure before him. "I never saw a sadder face," he recalled thinking at the time. Though the two men had never met, Speed had heard Lincoln speak a year earlier, and came away deeply impressed. Decades later, he could still recite Lincoln's concluding words. Turning to Lincoln, Speed said, "You seem to be so much pained at contracting so small a debt. I think I can suggest a plan by which you can avoid the debt and at the same time attain your end. I have a large room with a double bed upstairs, which you are very welcome to share with me." Lincoln reacted quickly to Speed's unexpected offer. Racing upstairs to deposit his bags in the loft, he came clattering down again, his face entirely transformed. Beaming with pleasure, he exclaimed, "Well, Speed, I am moved." 5 years younger than Lincoln, the handsome, blue-eyed Speed had been raised in a gracious mansion on his family's prosperous plantation, cultivated by more than 70 slaves. He had received an excellent education in the best Kentucky schools and at St. Joseph's College at Bardstown. While he could have remained at home, enjoying a life of ease, he determined to make his way west with the tide of his restless generation. Arriving in Springfield when he was 21, he had invested in real estate and become the proprietor of the town's general store. Lincoln and Speed shared the same room for nearly 4 years, sleeping in the same double bed. Over time, the two young men developed a close relationship, talking nightly of their hopes and their prospects, their mutual love of poetry and politics, their anxieties about women. They attended political meetings and forums together, went to dances and parties, relaxed with long rides in the countryside. Emerging from a childhood and young adulthood marked by isolation and loneliness, Lincoln discovered in Joshua Speed a companion with whom he could share his inner life. They had similar dispositions, both possessing an ambitious impulse to improve themselves and rise in the world. No longer a boy, but not yet an established adult, Lincoln ended years of emotional deprivation and intellectual solitude by building his first and deepest friendship with Speed. Openly acknowledging the strength of this attachment, the two pledged themselves to a lifelong bond of friendship. Those who knew Lincoln well pointed to Speed as his most intimate friend, the only person to whom he ever disclosed his secret thoughts. "You know my desire to befriend you is everlasting," Lincoln assured Speed, "that I will never cease while I know how to do anything." Some have suggested that there may have been a sexual relationship between Lincoln and Speed. Their intimacy, however, like the relationship between Seward and Burdan, and, as we shall see, between Chase and Stanton, is more an index to an era when close male friendships, accompanied by open expressions of affection and passion, were familiar and socially acceptable. Nor can sharing a bed be considered evidence of an erotic involvement. It was common practice, in an era when private quarters were a rare luxury, When males regularly slept in the same bed as children, and continued to do so in academies, boarding houses, and overcrowded hotels. The room above Speed's store functioned as a sort of dormitory, with two other young men living there part of the time, as well as Lincoln and Speed. The attorneys of the Eighth Circuit in Illinois, where Lincoln would travel, regularly shared beds, with the exception of Judge David Davis, whose immense girth left no room for a companion. As the historian Donald Iacovone writes in his study of the fiercely expressed love and devotion among several abolitionist leaders in the same era, the preoccupation with elemental sex reveals more about later centuries than about the 19th. If it is hard to delineate the exact nature of Lincoln's relationship with Speed, it is clear that this intimate friendship came at a critical juncture in his young life, as he struggled to define himself in a new city, away from home and family. Here, in Springfield, he would carry forward the twin careers that would occupy most of his life, law and politics. His accomplishments in escaping the confines of his barren, death-battered childhood, and his relentless self-education required luck, a stunning audacity, and a breadth of intelligence that was only beginning to reveal itself. Chapter 3. The Lure of Politics. In the only country founded on the principle that men should and could govern themselves, where self-government dominated every level of human association, from the smallest village to the nation's capital, it was natural that politics should be a consuming, almost universal, concern. "Scarcely have you descended on the soil of America," wrote Alexis de Tocqueville in the year Lincoln was serving his first term in the state legislature, "when you find yourself in the midst of a sort of tumult. A confused clamor is raised on all sides. A thousand voices come to your ear at the same time, each of them expressing some social needs. Around you, everything moves. Here, the people of one neighborhood have gathered to learn if a church ought to be built. There, they are working on the choice of a representative. Farther on, the deputies of a district are going to town in all haste in order to decide about some local improvements. In another place, the farmers of a village abandon their furrows to go discuss the plan of a road or a school. Citizens assemble with the sole goal of declaring that they disapprove of the course of government," Tocqueville wrote. "To meddle in the government of society, and to speak about it, is the greatest business, and, so to speak, the only pleasure that an American knows. An American does not know how to converse, but he discusses. He does not discourse, but he holds forth. He always speaks to you as to an assembly." In an illustration from Noah Webster's Elementary Spelling Book, widely read in Lincoln's generation, a man strikes a heroic pose as he stands on a wooden barrel speaking to a crowd of enthralled listeners. Behind him, the stars and stripes wave proudly, while a poster bearing the image of the national eagle connotes the bravery and patriotism of the orator. "Who can wonder," Ralph Waldo Emerson asked, "at the lure of politics for our ambitious young men, when the highest bribes of society are at the feet of the successful orator? He has his audience at his devotion. All other fames must hush before his." For many ambitious young men in the 19th century, politics proved the chosen arena for advancement. Politics attracted Bates in Missouri, Seward in upstate New York, Lincoln in Illinois, and Chase in Ohio. The oldest of the four, Edward Bates, was the first drawn into politics during the 1820 crusade for Missouri's statehood. As the petition was debated in the U.S. Congress, an argument arose as to whether the constitutional protection for slavery in the original states applied to the newly acquired territories. An anti-slavery representative from New York introduced an amendment requiring Missouri first to agree to emancipate all children of slaves on their 21st birthday. The so-called lawyer faction, including Edward Bates, vehemently opposed an anti-slavery restriction as the price of admission to the Union. Bates argued that it violated the Constitution by imposing a qualification on a state beyond providing a republican form of government, as guaranteed by the Constitution. To Northerners who hoped containment in the South would lead inevitably to the end of slavery, its introduction into the new territories aroused fear that it would now infiltrate the West, and thereby the nation's future. For Southerners invested in slave labor, Northern opposition to Missouri's admission as a slave state posed a serious threat to their way of life. At the height of the struggle, Southern leaders declared their intent to secede from the Union. Many Northerners seemed willing to let them go. "This momentous question," Jefferson wrote at the time, "like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I considered it at once as the knell of the Union." The Senate ultimately stripped the bill of the anti-slavery amendment, bringing Missouri into the Union as a slave state under the famous Missouri Compromise of 1820. Fashioned by Kentucky Senator Henry Clay, who earned the nickname the Great Pacificator, the compromise simultaneously admitted Maine as a free state and prohibited slavery in all the remaining Louisiana Purchase territory north of the latitude 36 degrees 30 minutes. That line ran across the southern border of Missouri, making Missouri itself an exception to the new division. Later that spring, Bates campaigned successfully for a place among the 41 delegates chosen to write the new state's constitution. Though younger than most of the delegates, he emerged as one of the principal authors of the Constitution. When the time came to select candidates for state offices, the lawyer faction received the lion's share. David Barton and Thomas Benton were sent to Washington as Missouri's first senators, and Edward Bates became the state's first attorney general. His partner, Joshua Barton, became the first Secretary of State. 2 years later, Bates won a seat in the Missouri House, and 2 years after that, Frederick Bates was elected governor of the state. This inner circle did not remain united for long, for tensions developed between Senators Barton and Benton. Barton's followers were primarily merchants and landowners, while Benton gradually aligned himself with the agrarian disciples of Jacksonian democracy. A tragic duel made the split irrevocable. In the course of his legal practice, Bates's partner, Joshua Barton, found proof of corruption in the office of Benton's friend and ally, Missouri's Land Surveyor General William Rector. Rector challenged Barton to a duel, in which Barton was killed. Bates was devastated by the loss of his friend. He and David Barton went public with Joshua Barton's indictment, implicating Benton as well as Rector. They demanded an investigation from U.S. Attorney General William Wirt, Chase's mentor and friend. The investigation sustained most of the charges and resulted in President Monroe's dismissal of Rector. The affair came to an end, but the rift between Barton and Benton never healed. Proponents of Barton, including Bates, eventually coalesced into the Whig Party, while the Bentonites became Democrats. The Whigs favored public support for internal improvements designed to foster business in a new market economy. Their progressive agenda included protective tariffs and a national banking system to develop and strengthen the resources of the country. The Democrats, with their base of power in the agrarian South, resisted these measures, appealing instead to the interests of the common man against the bankers, the lawyers, and the merchants. Despite his immersion in the whirlpool of Missouri politics, an event occurred in 1823 that altered Bates's life and forever shifted his focus. He fell in love with and married Julia Coulter. Thereafter, home and family domesticity eclipsed politics as the signal pleasure of his life. His first child, named Joshua Barton Bates, in honor of his slain partner, was born in 1824. Over the next 25 years, 16 more children were born. When Julia was young, family friend John Darby recalled, she was a most beautiful woman. She came from a distinguished South Carolina family that settled in Missouri when she was a child. Her father was a wealthy man, having invested successfully in land. The husband of one of her sisters became governor of South Carolina. Another sister was married to the chancellor of the state of Missouri. A third sister married Hamilton Rowan Gamble, who served as a justice on Missouri's Supreme Court, and wrote a dissenting opinion in the Dred Scott case. Despite these connections, Julia had little interest in politics. Her attentions were fully focused on her family. Her surviving letters, unlike those of Francis Seward, said nothing about the issues of the day, concentrating instead on her children's activities, their eating habits, their games, their broken bones. Her entire being, Darby observed, was calculated to impart happiness around the domestic circle. She succeeded in this beyond ordinary measure, providing Edward with what their friends uniformly described as an ideal home life. The enticements of public office gradually diminished in his contented eyes. When he sought and won a seat in the U.S. Congress in 1826, 3 years after his marriage, his pleasure in the victory was dimmed by the necessity of leaving home and hearth. Even short absences from Julia proved painful for him. "I have never found it so difficult to keep up my spirits," he confessed to her at one point, when she had gone to visit friends for several days. "Indeed, ever since you left me, I have felt a painful consciousness of being alone. At court I can do well enough, but when I come home, to bed or board, I feel so utterly solitary that I can enjoy neither eating nor sleeping. I mention these things not because it is either proper or becoming to feel them, but because they are novel to me. I never before had such a restless, dissatisfied, indefinable feeling, and never wish to have it again." Disquiet returned 100-fold when he departed on the lonely journey to take up his congressional seat in Washington, leaving his pregnant wife and small son at home. Writing from various taverns and boarding houses along the way, he confessed that he was in something of a melancholy and melting mood. There was a magic in her loveliness which left him like a schoolboy lover in the absence of his dear Julia. Now, after only a few weeks away, he was moved to cry, "A plague upon the vanity of petty ambition! Were I great enough to sway the destinies of the nation, the meed of ambition might be worth the sacrifice which it requires. But a mere seat in Congress as a subaltern member is a contemptible price for the happiness which we enjoy with each other. It was always your opinion, and now I feel it to be true." His spirits revived somewhat when he settled into a comfortable Washington boarding house and took his seat in Congress alongside David Crockett, James Polk, and Henry Clay. Though Bates seldom went out to parties, preferring to spend his nights reading and writing to his wife, he was thrilled, he told Julia, to spend a private evening with Henry Clay. "That man grows upon me more and more every time I see him," he wrote. "There is an intuitive perception about him that seems to see and understand at a glance, and a winning fascination in his manners that will suffer none to be his enemies who associate with him." The main issues that confronted Bates during his congressional term concerned the disposition of Western lands, internal improvements, and the tariff. On each of these issues, Senators Benton and Barton were antagonists. Benton had introduced a bill under which the federal government would make its lands available to settlers at a price so low that it was almost free. Cheap land, he argued, would bridle the rampant speculation that profited the few over the many. Barton countered with the claim that such cheap land would depress the entire Western economy. Bates sided with Barton, voting against the popular bill. During the dispute over public lands, Bates published a pamphlet denouncing Benton that so angered Old Bullion, as he was known, that the two men did not speak for nearly a quarter of a century. "My piece is burning into his reputation," Bates told Julia, "like aquafortis upon iron. The mark can never be effaced." Beyond his open quarrel with Benton, Bates got along well with his colleagues. His natural warmth and easy manner created respect and affection. Night sessions he found particularly amusing and intriguing, despite the roaring disorder of people hawking, coughing, thumping with their canes, and kicking about spitboxes. The hall, suffused with candlelight from members' desks and from the massive chandelier suspended from the domed ceiling, exhibited a most magnificent appearance. Nonetheless, these few moments of pleasure could not compensate for missing the birth of his first daughter, Nancy. "As yet, I only know that she is," he lamented. "I long to know how she is, what she is, who she is like, whether she has black eyes or gray, a long nose or a pug, a wide mouth or a narrow one, and above all, whether she has a pretty foot. For without a pretty foot, like her mother's," he predicted, "she could never make a fine woman." "Oh, how I long to see and press you to my bosom," he told Julia, "if it were but for a moment. Sometimes I almost realize the vision. I see you with such vivid and impassioned precision that the very form developing is in my eye." In letter after letter, the physical immediacy of their relationship becomes clear. Responding to Julia's admission of her own downcast spirits, he wrote, "Oh, that I could kiss the tear from that cheek whose cheerful brightness is my sunshine." Still, public life enticed him, and at the behest of his friends and supporters, Bates agreed to run for a second term. Despite his great personal popularity, he lost his bid for re-election in the wake of the great Jacksonian landslide that gave Benton and the Democrats complete control of Missouri politics. During the last days of his term, the usually soft-spoken Bates got into a heated argument with Congressman George McDuffie of South Carolina on the floor of the House. McDuffie ridiculed him personally, and Bates impulsively challenged the South Carolinian to a duel. Fortunately, McDuffie declined, agreeing to apologize for his offensive language. Years later, reflecting on the Southern code of dueling, Bates's friend, Charles Gibson, maintained that as wicked as the code was, the vulgar public behavior following the demise of the practice was worse still. The code preserved a dignity, justice, and decorum that have since been lost, he argued, to the great detriment of the professions, the public, and the government. The present generation will think me barbarous, but I believe that some lives lost in protecting the tone of the bar and the press, on which the Republic itself so largely depends, are well spent. As the 36-year-old Bates packed up his documents and books to return home, he assured Julia that he was genuinely relieved to have lost. While he loved his friends, as much as any man, he wrote, "For happiness I look alone to the bosom of my own family." Not a day passed, he happily reported, that he did not divide and subdivide his time by making plans for their future. He meant, first of all, to take and maintain a station in the front rank of his profession, so that he could provide for his family all the various little comforts and amusements we have often talked over and wished we possessed. Months and years slipped by, and Bates remained true to his word. Though he served 2 terms in the state legislature, where he was regarded as the ablest and most eloquent member of that body, he decided in 1835 to devote his full attention to his flourishing law practice rather than run for re-election. Throughout the prime of his life, therefore, Bates found his chief gratification in home and family. His charming diary, faithfully recorded for more than 3 decades, provides a vivid testament to his domestic preoccupations. While ruminations upon ambition, success, and power are ubiquitous in Chase's introspective diary, Bates focused on the details of everyday life, the comings and goings of his children, the progress of his garden, and the social events in his beloved St. Louis. His interest in history, he once observed, lay less in the usual records of wars and dynasties than in the more neglected areas of domestic laws, morals, and social manners. The smallest details of his children's lives fascinated him. When Ben, his 14th child, was born, he noted the curious fact that the child had a birthmark on the right side of his belly resembling a frog. Attempting to explain one of the mysteries in which God has shrouded nature, he recalled that a few weeks before the child was born, while his wife lay on the bed reading, she was unpleasantly startled by the sudden appearance of a tree frog. At the time, she was lying on her left side, with her right hand resting on her body above the hip, Bates noted, and in the corresponding part of the child's body is the distinct mark of the frog. Faith in the powers of God irradiates the pages of his diary. His son Julian, a bad stammerer from his childhood, the family had begun to fear that he was incurable, miraculously began one day to speak without the slightest hesitation. "A new faculty," Bates recorded, "is given to one who seemed to have been cut off from one of the chief blessings of humanity." In return for this restoration to speech, Bates hoped that his son would eventually qualify himself to preach the gospel, for he had never seen in any youth a more devoted piety. Sadly, the miracle did not last long. Within 6 months, Julian was stuttering again. On rare occasions when his wife left to visit relatives, Bates mourned her absence from the home where she was both mistress and queen. He reminded himself that he must not begrudge her the short respite from the innumerable tasks of caring for a large family. Giving birth to 17 children in 32 years, Julia was pregnant throughout nearly all her childbearing years. Savoring the warmth of his family circle, he felt the loss of each child who grew up and moved away. "This day," he noted in 1851, "my son Barton, with his family, wife and 1 child, moved into his new house. He has lived with us ever since his marriage in March 1849. This is a serious diminution of our household. Being worried that as our children are fast growing up, and will soon scatter about in search of their own futures, we may soon expect to have but a little family in a large house. The diaries Bates kept also reveal a deep commitment to his home city of St. Louis. Every year, on April 29, he marked the anniversary of his first arrival in the town. As the years passed, he witnessed mighty changes in population, locomotion, commerce, and the arts, which made St. Louis the jewel of the great Mississippi Valley, and would, he predicted, eventually make it the ruling city of the continent. His entries proudly record the first gas illumination of the streets, the transmission of the first telegraph between St. Louis and the eastern cities, and the first day that a railroad train moved west of the Mississippi. Bates witnessed a great fire in 1849 that reduced the commercial section of the city to rubble, and endured a cholera epidemic that same year that killed more than 100 each day, hearses rolling through the muddy streets from morning till night. In 1 week alone, he recorded, the total deaths numbered nearly 1,000. His own family pulled through in perfect health, in part, he believed, because they rejected the general opinion of avoiding fruits and vegetables. He agonized over the medical ignorance about the origin of the disease or its remedy. "No two of them agree with each other, and no one agrees with himself 2 weeks at a time." As the epidemic worsened, scores of families left the city in fear of contagion, but Bates refused to do so. To a friend who had offered sanctuary on his plantation outside of the city, he explained, "I am one of the oldest of the American inhabitants, have a good share of public respect and confidence, and consequently some influence with the people. I hold it to be a sacred duty, that admits of no compromise, to stand my ground and be ready to do and to bear my part. I should be ashamed to leave St. Louis under existing circumstances. It would be an abandonment of a known duty." Beyond commentary on his family and his city, Bates filled the pages of his diary with observations of the changing seasons, the progress of his flowers, and the phases of the moon. He celebrated the first crocus each year, his elm trees shedding seed, oaks in full tassel, tulips in their prime. So vivid are his descriptions of his garden that the reader can almost hear the rustling leaves of fall, or the frogs croaking in full chorus that filled the spring nights. With an acute eye, he observed that plants change color with age. Meticulously noting variations and difference, he never felt that he was repeating the same patterns of activity year after year. He was a contented man. However, he never fully abandoned his interest in politics. His passion for the development of the West led him to a major role in the River and Harbor Convention, called in the late 1840s, to protest President Polk's veto of the Whig-sponsored Internal Improvements Bill. The assembly is said to have been the largest convention ever gathered in the United States prior to the Civil War. More than 5,000 accredited delegates and countless other spectators joined Chicago's 16,000 inhabitants, filling every conceivable room in every hotel, boarding house, and private dwelling. Desperate visitors to the overcrowded city even sought places to sleep aboard boats in Chicago's harbor. Former and future governors, congressmen, and senators were there, including Tom Corwin from Ohio, Thurlow Weed and New York Tribune editor Horace Greeley from New York, and Schuyler Colfax of Indiana, who was chosen to serve as secretary of the convention. New York was also represented by Democrat David Dudley Field, designated to present Polk's arguments against federal appropriations for internal improvements in the states. Also in attendance, Greeley wrote, was Honorable Abraham Lincoln, a tall specimen of an Illinoisan, just elected to Congress from the only Whig district in the state. It was Lincoln's first mention in a paper of national repute. No one who saw Lincoln can forget his personal appearance at that time, one delegate recalled years later. Tall, angular, and awkward, he had on a short-waisted, thin swallowtail coat, a short vest of same material, thin pantaloons, scarcely coming down to his ankles, a straw hat, and a pair of brogans with woolen socks. On the first day, Edward Bates was chosen president of the convention, much to his deep astonishment, given the presence of so many eminent delegates. If notice had been given me of any intention to nominate me for the presidency of the convention, I should have shrunk from it with dread and repressed the attempt, Bates confided to his diary. He was apprehensive that party politics would render the convention unsuccessful, and that he would then bear the brunt of responsibility for its failure. Yet so skillfully and impartially did he conduct the proceedings, and so eloquently did he make the case for internal improvements and development of the inland waterways, that he leaped at one bound into national prominence. On a much smaller scale, Lincoln impressed the audience with his clever rebuttal of the arguments against public support for internal improvements advanced by Democrat Field. At the close of the convention, Bates delivered the final speech. No complete record of this speech was made, for once Bates began speaking, the reporters, Weed confessed, were too intent and absorbed as listeners to think of reporting. "No account that can now be given will do it justice," Horace Greeley wrote in the New York Tribune the following week. In clear, compelling language, Bates described the country poised at a dangerous crossroad between sectional disruption and unbounded prosperity. He called on the various regions of the nation to speak in voices of moderation and compromise, for only by statesmanlike concession could problems of slavery and territorial acquisition be solved so the nation could move on to material greatness. While he was speaking, Weed reported, he was interrupted continually by cheer upon cheer, and at its close the air rung with shout after shout from the thousands in attendance. Overwhelmed by the reaction, Bates considered the speech the crowning act of his life, received as he never knew a speech received before. The immense assembly, Bates noted in his diary, seemed absolutely mesmerized, their bodies and hearts and minds subjected to my will, and answering to my every thought and sentiment with the speed and exactness of electricity. And when I ceased to speak, there was one loud, long, and spontaneous burst of sympathy and joyous gratification, the like of which I never expect to witness again. Bates acknowledged when he returned home that his vanity had been flattered, his pride of character stimulated in a manner and a degree far beyond what I thought could ever reach me in this lifelong retirement to which I have withdrawn. The experience was more full of public honor and private gratification than any passage of my life. Those 3 days at Chicago have given me a fairer representation and a higher standing in the nation than I could have hoped to attain by years of labor and anxiety in either House of Congress. With that single speech, Bates had become a prominent national figure, his name heralded in papers across the country as a leading prospect for high public office once the Whigs were returned to power. The nation cannot afford to be deprived of so much integrity, talent, and patriotism, Weed concluded at the end of a long, flattering piece calling on Bates to re-enter political life. While Bates initially basked in such a claim, within weeks of the convention's close, he convinced himself he no longer craved what he later called the glittering bauble of political success. Declining Weed's appeal that he returned to public life, he wrote the editor a pensive letter. Once, he revealed to Weed, he had entertained such noble aspirations to make his mind the mind of other men. But these desires were now gone. His habits formed and stiffened to the standard of professional and domestic life. Consequently, there was no office in the gift of prince or people that he would accept. His refusal, he explained, was the natural result of his social position, his domestic relations, and his responsibilities to his large family. Seward was next to enter public life, realizing, after several uninspired years of practicing law, that he had no ambition for its honors. Though resigned to his profession, with so much cheerfulness that his disinclination was never suspected, he found himself perusing newspapers and magazines at every free moment, while scrutinizing his law books only when he needed them for a case. He was discovering, he said, that politics was the important and engrossing business of the country. Fate provided an introduction to Thurlow Weed, the man who would secure his entry into the political world and facilitate his rise to prominence. Seward was on an excursion to Niagara Falls with Frances, her father, and his parents, when the wheel of their stagecoach broke off, throwing the passengers into a swampy ravine. A tall, powerfully built man with deep-set blue eyes appeared and helped everyone to safety. He introduced himself as Thurlow Weed, editor of a Rochester newspaper, which he printed chiefly with his own hand. That encounter sparked a friendship that would shape the destinies of both men. 4 years Seward's senior, Thurlow Weed could see at a glance that his new acquaintance was an educated young man belonging to the best society. Weed himself had grown up in poverty, his father frequently imprisoned for debt, his family forced to move from one upstate location to another. Apprenticed in a blacksmith's shop at 8 years old, with only a few years of formal schooling behind him, he had fought to educate himself. He had walked miles to borrow books, studying history and devouring newspapers by firelight. A classic example of a self-made man, he no sooner identified an obstacle to his progress than he worked with discipline to counteract it. Concerned that he lacked a native facility for remembering names and appointments, and believing that a politician who sees a man once should remember him forever, Weed consciously trained his memory. He spent 15 minutes every night telling his wife, Catherine, everything that had happened to him that day, everyone he had met, the exact words spoken. The nightly mnemonics worked, for Weed soon became known as a man with a phenomenal recall. Gifted with abundant energy, shrewd intelligence, and a warm personality, he managed to carve out a brilliant career as printer, editor, writer, publisher, and eventually as a powerful political boss, familiarly known as the Dictator. Weed undoubtedly sensed in the younger Seward an instinct for power and a fascination with politics that matched his own. In an era when political parties were in flux, Weed and Seward gravitated toward the proponents of a new infrastructure for the country, those who wished to deepen waterways and create a new network of roads and rails. Such measures, Seward believed, along with a national banking system and protective tariffs, would enable the nation to strengthen its foundations, increase its numbers, develop its resources, and extend its dominion. Eventually, those in favor of the American system, as it came to be called, coalesced behind Henry Clay's Whig Party. Weed's star rose rapidly in New York when, with Seward's help, he launched the Albany Evening Journal, first published in March 1830. The influential journal, which eventually became the party organ for the Whigs and later for the Republicans, gave Weed a powerful base from which he would brilliantly shape public opinion for nearly four decades. Through his newspapers, Weed engineered Seward's first chance for political office. In September 1830, Seward secured the nomination for a seat in the state Senate from the 7th District. That November, with Weed managing every step of the campaign, Seward won a historic victory as the youngest member to enter the New York Senate. He was 29. Albany had nearly doubled in size since Seward had first seen it, but it was still a small town of 24,000 inhabitants. Originally settled by the Dutch, the state's capital boasted a stately array of brick mansions that belonged to wealthy merchant princes. The year before Seward's arrival, ground had been broken for the country's first steam-powered railroad. This 16-mile track, connecting Albany with Schenectady, was the first link in an eventual nationwide web of tracks. The legislature consisted of 32 senators and 128 representatives, most of whom boarded in either the Eagle Tavern on South Market Street or around the corner on State Street at Beaumont's Hotel. Such close quarters, while congenial to politicians, were ill-suited to families, especially those, like Seward's, with small children. Consequently, Seward decided to attend the four-month winter session alone. "Weed is very much with me, and I enjoy his warmth of feeling," Seward confided to Francis after he had settled into Beaumont's, describing his friend as one of the greatest politicians of the age, the magician whose wand controls and directs the party. Despite Weed's eminence, Seward proudly noted, "he sits down, stretches one of his long legs out to rest on my coal box, I cross my own, and, puffing the smoke of our cigars into each other's faces, we talk of everything and everybody except politics." They enjoyed a mutual love of the theater and a passion for the novels of Charles Dickens and Walter Scott. Their shared ambition, for each other and their country, became a common bond that would keep their friendship alive until the end of their days. Seward's gregarious nature was in perfect harmony with the club-like atmosphere of the boarding houses, where colleagues took their daily meals together and spent evenings in one another's quarters gathered by the fire. "My room is a thoroughfare," he told Francis. Early in the session, he befriended an older colleague, Albert Haller Tracy, a senator from Buffalo who had served three terms in the U.S. Congress and had once been touted as a candidate for vice president. In recent years, however, a series of debilitating illnesses had stalled Tracy's political ambitions and crushed all his aspirings. In Seward, perhaps, he found a young man who could fulfill the dreams he had once held dear. "I believe Henry tells him everything that passes in his mind," Frances Seward wrote to her sister, Lizette. "He and Henry appear equally in love with each other." "It shames my manhood that I am so attached to you," Tracy confessed to Seward after several days' absence from Albany. "It is a foolish fondness from which no good can come." His friendship with another colleague, Tracy explained, was just right. It fills my heart exactly. But yours crowds it, producing a kind of girlish impatience which one can neither dispose of nor comfortably endure. Every day and almost every hour since leaving, I have suffered a womanish longing to see you. But all this is too ridiculous for the subject matter of a letter between two grave senators, and I leave unsaid 3/4 of what I have been dreaming on since I left Albany." Seward at first reciprocated Tracy's feelings, professing a rapturous joy in discovering that his friend shared the feelings which I had become half ashamed for their effeminacy to confess I possessed. In time, however, Tracy's intensity began to wear on the relationship. When Seward did not immediately respond to one of his letters, Tracy penned a petulant note. "My feelings, confined in narrow channels, have outstripped yours, which naturally are more diffused. I was foolish enough to make an almost exclusive attachment the measure for one which is divided with many." Tracy's ardor would fuel an intense rivalry with Thurlow Weed. "Weed has never been to see us since Tracy came," Frances told her sister during a visit to Albany. "I am sorry for this, although I can hardly account for it." Confronted with the need to choose, Seward turned to Weed, not Tracy, for vital collaboration. Although Tracy continued a cordial association with Seward, he harbored a smoldering resentment over Seward's increasing closeness to Weed. "Love, cruel tyrant as he is," Tracy reminded Seward, "has made reciprocity both the bond and aliment of our most hallowed affections." Absent that reciprocity, Tracy warned, it would be impossible to sustain the glorious friendship that they had once enjoyed. A strange turn in Tracy's affections likely resulted from his mounting sense of distance from Seward. He transferred his unrequited love from Henry to Frances, who also was feeling distant from her husband. Though still deeply in love after 10 years of marriage, Frances worried that her husband's passion for politics and worldly achievement surpassed his love for his family. She mourned, "losing my influence over a heart I once thought so entirely my own," increasingly apprehensive that she and her husband were differently constituted. In 1832, Seward convinced Frances to accompany him to Albany for the legislative session that ran from January to March. Their quarters on the first floor of Beaumont's Hotel were just below those taken by Tracy and his wife Harriet. The two couples would often spend evenings or weekends together, and Tracy often tagged along with Henry and Frances when his wife was on one of her frequent trips to their home in Buffalo. He joined them on walks, shopping trips, and excursions with the children. "He is a singular being," Frances confided to Lizette. "He certainly knows more than any man I ever was acquainted with. His conversation," she marveled, "reminds me of a book of synonyms. He hardly ever makes use of the same words to express ideas that have a shade of difference." Capitalizing on Francis's hunger for companionship, Tracy insinuated himself into the private emotional world she once shared only with her husband. He spoke with her freely about his quarrels with his wife. He invited her into his sitting room to read poetry and study French. They talked about their battles with ill health. "I believe, at present, he could convince me that a chameleon was blue, green, or black, just as he should choose," Frances admitted to Lizette. Following one extended absence, Frances announced unabashedly that she was "very glad to see him, as I love him very much." Though there is no indication that Frances and Tracy ever shared a physical relationship, they had entered into something that was considered, in the subtle realm of Victorian social mores, almost as shameful and inappropriate, a private emotional intimacy. The following summer, Seward left his wife and family in Auburn to accompany his father on a 3-month voyage to Europe. While his aging father's need for companionship provided a rationale for the sojourn, Seward relished the opportunity to see foreign lands and observe new cultures. Father and son traveled extensively through England, Ireland, Holland, Switzerland, Italy, and France. "What a romance was this journey that I was making," Seward recalled years later. Everywhere he went, however, his thoughts returned to America and his faith in his country's unique future. It is not until one visits old, oppressed, suffering Europe that he can appreciate his own government, he observed. that he realizes the fearful responsibility of the American people to the nations of the whole earth, to carry successfully through the experiment that men are capable of self-government. He hungrily sought out American newspapers in library reading rooms, noting with regret ubiquitous reports of malicious political warfare. While Lincoln, Chase, and Bates would never visit the old world, Seward, at the age of 32, mingled comfortably with members of Parliament and received invitations to elegant receptions and dinner parties throughout Europe. In France, Seward spent a long weekend visiting with the Revolutionary War hero General Lafayette at his home, La Grange. In Seward's absence, Francis corresponded frequently with Tracy. When Judge Miller noticed a letter in an unknown hand awaiting Francis on the mantelpiece, he demanded to see it. Francis did not know what to do, she explained to her sister. I handed it to him, and he very deliberately commenced breaking the seal for the purpose of reading it. My first impulse was to jump up and snatch the letter from his hand, which I did, and then apologized by saying I would prefer reading it myself first. He appeared very much astonished that I should be so unreasonable. As Tracy's letters multiplied, the deeply religious Francis began to contemplate the perilous shift in their friendship. Mortified in front of Henry, now returned from Europe, she proffered the letters, asking him to determine if Tracy was endeavoring to break their marital peace. At first, Seward refused to read them, unwilling to impute such dishonorable intentions to Tracy. When a further letter arrived that caused Frances to collapse in tears, believing herself dishonored in both Tracy's and her husband's eyes, Seward resolved to confront him. The next time the two men met in Albany, however, Seward made no mention of the delicate situation, nor did he bring it up in the following months, for his attention was increasingly consumed by politics. 4 years in the state Senate had proved Seward an eloquent voice for reform. He had denounced imprisonment for debt, urged separate prisons for men and women, and pushed for internal improvements, all the while maintaining friendly relations on both sides of the aisle. It was time, Weed believed, to push his protege toward higher office. At the September 1834 convention in Utica, New York, Weed convinced members of the newly organized Whig Party that the young, energetic Seward would wage the best campaign for governor against the heavily favored Democrats. Seward was thrilled. Needing all the support he could gather, he did not want to risk alienating the influential Albert Tracy. Promises he had made to his wife could wait. Brimming with high expectations in his upstart race, Seward eagerly embraced the Whig platform that promised to deliver for the nation something of the progress he had achieved for himself. Despite Weed's caution that he faced an uphill battle, his native optimism would not be dampened. The campaign, complete with slogans and songs, was a lively affair. To counter charges that the boyish, red-haired Seward was too young for high office, the Whigs offered a gallery of historical figures who had achieved greatness in their youth, including Charlemagne, Napoleon, Lafayette, Mozart, Newton, and, of course, Whig leader Henry Clay himself. Seward anticipated victory until the final votes were tallied over a 3-day period in November 1834. Defeat shook the usually buoyant Seward to the core. He began to reevaluate his present life, his marriage, and his future. Obliged to return to Albany that December for the final session of the state Senate, where he was a lame duck, he fell into an uncharacteristic state of melancholy. Unable to sleep, Seward feared that his consuming ambition, which had kept him away from his wife and children for months, had jeopardized his marriage. "What a demon is this ambition," he lamented from Albany, baring his soul in a long, emotional letter to his wife. Ambition had led him to stray, he now realized, in thought, purpose, communion, and sympathy from the only being who purely loves me. He confessed that he had thought her love only an incident among his many passions, when in truth it was the chief good of his life. This realization, he feared, had come too late to win back her love. I banished you from my heart. I made it so desolate, so destitute of sympathy for you, of everything which you ought to have found there, that you could no longer dwell in it. And when the wretched T., Tracy, took advantage of my madness and offered sympathies and feelings and love such as I never did, and your expelled heart was half won by his falsehoods, God be praised for the escape of both of us from that fearful peril. Loved, injured, and angel spirit, receive this homage of my first return to reason and truth. Say to me that, understanding my own feelings, yours are not crushed. Failing to receive an immediate reply from Francis, Seward tossed in his bed. He felt cold, clammy, and feverish. For the first time, the possibility occurred to him that his wife might have fallen out of love, and he was horrified. "I am growing womanish in fears," he admitted in a second heartfelt letter. "Tell me in your own dear way that I am loved and cherished in your heart as I used to be when I better deserved so happy a lot." Finally, Seward received the answer he longed to hear. "You reproach yourself."